So is Donald Trump good for the Jewish people of America or not?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you, always counting the seconds before the broadcast starts because I so look forward to this time together. If you have a Jewish-related question for me, if you're a Jewish person, you differ with me in my views about Jesus, Yeshua, if you are listener, caller with any background and you just have a Jewish-related question about Israel, Hebrew language, Jewish tradition, Hebrew Bible, give me a call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. And as always, my special appeal to those who differ with me on any of these issues, give us a call. I want to bring you some perspective today in terms of Jewish voting and Donald Trump. With the elections upon us, this is not to argue for a position, defend a position, criticize a position. It's simply to give you information, give you insight into how many Jewish people think in America. I'm going to do that in a moment, give you some feedback from a liberal Jewish publication, The Forward, but one that represents the voices of many Jews in America. And before that, just some updates on the peace treaty. So remarkably, not just United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have said they're going to normalize relations with Israel, each one in a different way. But now Sudan. So Sudan and Northern Africa, dominated by Islam, especially in one half of the nation. Christians there are terribly persecuted over the years, recognized as a terrorist state. Sudan has now said they're going to normalize relations. Looking at a headline in Times of Israel, Sudan's leader, "We weren't blackmailed. We're the biggest winners of Israel deal." And the General Burhan, leader of the country, says that the decision to normalize ties with Israel was an incentive for U.S. President Donald Trump's administration to end Sudan's international pariah status. General Abdel Fattah Burhan, head of the ruling Sovereign Council, told state television that without the normalization with the Jewish state now, Sudan would have had to have waited deep into next year to be removed from the U.S.'s list of state sponsors of terrorism. So, in other words, they're saying, hey, this is good for us. And yeah, we stand for a Palestinian state. We stand with the Palestinians, but that's not just our responsibility. So we're going to do this as a good faith sign that we do not want to be looked at as terrorists. Now, what's interesting is that Saudi Arabia reportedly will also sign. I mean, this is big with Saudi income and influence in the Muslim world. And look, this is where Mecca and Medina are, in Saudi Arabia. You make the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage that Muslims try to make once in a lifetime. That is to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. So for Saudi Arabia to normalize ties with Israel is massive. Reportedly, they will be doing that soon. And Trump says that a number of other nations are going to follow suit. This is massive. This is historic. This is unprecedented. And it's so big that some prophecy teachers are wondering, is this going to usher in the false peace under the Antichrist? Is this a bad thing? And I understand those concerns, and I understand the prophecies that could point in that direction. But when you have an opportunity to make peace and normalize relations with enemies, and you can do it without compromising your own soul in the process, without hurting your own country in the process, you do that. You don't say, well, we can't do X, Y, Z because of potential prophecy. No, you do it as best as you can. 866-34-TRUTH. Okay, there is an article on Forward.com. Actually, I want to grab a couple from Forward. 50 years of Jewish voting habits deconstructed. 50 years of Jewish voting habits deconstructed. The article published, Yeah, today, by Molly Boygon, says this. Throughout the turbulent last 4 years, various pundits have predicted that President Donald Trump could attract unusually high numbers of Jewish votes during the 2020 election cycle or lose many of the ones he had in 2016. As America careens toward the historic election day, it's a good description, the picture remains a bit muddled with news coverage of Orthodox protesters waving Trump flags juxtaposed against groups like Jewish Unity PAC, contributing tens of thousands of dollars to the president's Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden. A poll published last month by Jewish Electorate Institute said that 67% of Jewish voters were supporting Biden and 30% Trump, a shift of 4 points in favor of the incumbent from the 2016 breakdown between Trump and Hillary Clinton. Now, let me just step back for a minute and say, growing up, I grew up with a family where my dad is a liberal Democrat and where other family members, Democrats, most of them, as far as I know, lifelong Democrats to this moment. So cousins or, you know, others like that, and Jewish friends that I grew up with, some of them, interestingly, have become very conservative, and they're not believers. They become very conservative. They just looked at what was happening in the world around them, and they made a dramatic shift. But the bulk would remain liberal Democrats. That's what I grew up with. That was the norm. But again, a lot has changed, and there have been some shifts. So very, very interesting to go back. I want to look at some of this data. So go back to 1980. And some of this, frankly, if I knew it, I forgot it. So I was, whoa, that's very interesting to see. So 1980, Jimmy Carter got 45% of the Jewish vote, and Ronald Reagan got 39%. What? I thought Democrats always voted liberal, and Republicans always, Democrats, liberal, and Jewish vote all going in one direction, and Republicans, Christian, conservative, in the other direction. 45% of the Jewish vote went to Jimmy Carter and 39% to Ronald Reagan. So forward comments looking back to 1972, the closest America got to Jexit or Jexodus of Jewish voters from the Democratic Party was in 1980, but many of them went to a third party candidate, independent John Anderson. So Kenneth Wald, a professor of political science at the University of Florida and the author of Foundations of American Jewish Liberalism, said the drop in Jewish support for the Democrat was largely explained by the widespread dissatisfaction with President Carter among Democrats generally, but that there was also a perception that he was more sympathetic to the Palestinians than to Israel, which turns out to be true. Early in President Carter's term in the White House, he called for a Palestinian homeland, and in 1978, he proposed the sale of a fighter aircraft to Saudi Arabia, a move strongly opposed by Israel. Of course, that's a lot of water under the bridge since then. The shift in Jewish votes to the Republican can also be attributed to Reagan's strong record on Israel and anti-Semitism. Before running for office, he resigned from a country club in Los Angeles because he did not admit Jews and spoke out in support of Israel during the Six-Day War in 67. All right, now, come to 1992. All right, so we've got this is, and this is just where it's jumping us to, all right? Clinton versus George H.W. Bush. So George H.W. Bush running second time around. Look at this. Clinton gets 80% of the Jewish vote, and George H.W. Bush, 11%. Wow. What a dramatic shift. So when looking at the period from 72 to the present, Jews voted roughly 2-1 Democratic for the first five elections, but the 1992 election represented a cementing of Jewish American support for the Democratic Party. So the question is why? One reason, the rise of the Christian right in the 1980s and 90s and its influence on the Republican leadership made the Republican Party an inhospitable home, according to Kenneth Wald. So George H.W. Bush got 35% of the Jewish vote in 88, but then only 11% in 1992. So according to the analysis, Jews began to see another threat to the classical liberalism that had been their religion in a way, and that was the emergence of Christian conservatism as a political movement. That movement into the Republican Party of Evangelicals really stopped any Jewish progress towards Republicanism. White Protestant evangelicals today are as Republican as Jews are Democratic. Okay, so this is really interesting now. Think about this for a minute. What happens is, as Christian evangelicals increasingly are involved with the Republican Party increasingly espousing their values, the Democratic Party increasingly not espousing their values, so you have an increase in their involvement in the Republican Party. They are pro-Israel, by and large, strongly pro-Israel. But the feeling for many Jews is it's not our party. This is an evangelical, conservative, Christian, fundamentalist party. That's not our party. So it's very interesting to see how that shift takes place. Okay, so let's fast forward, all right? Let's fast forward to 2012. 2012, Barack Obama gets 69% of the Jewish vote. Mitt Romney gets 30%. Now, 71% of Jewish people supported Hillary Clinton in 2016. 69% supported Barack Obama in 2012, right? So this has been pretty close, pretty even. The data suggested that Romney received more of the Jewish vote in 2012 than most Republicans before him, right? So George H.W. Bush, George Bush, which some pollsters have explained as either a sign of effective messaging by Romney on Israel or ineffective messaging by Obama on Israel. Others believe that Jewish voters felt some identification with Romney, who is Mormon, as a fellow religious minority. But Walt said that a study he did found that the Romney data, which relied on exit polls, did not properly weight the sample for the distribution of the Jewish population. In other words, during the Romney exit polls, pollsters spoke to more Jews from conservative states than represented a smaller share of the country's Jewish population than they did other elections. So it's skewed. In other words, Romney did not get that higher percentage of the Jewish vote, according to this other analysis. Either way, there's great division about Donald Trump and the Jewish community. The more religious the Jews are, the more they'll vote Republican because of conservative family values and fear of where the Democratic Party is going and the rising anti-Semitism within the Democratic Party. More liberal Jews will vote more Democratic. How do they view Trump? Do they recognize Trump's strong solidarity with Israel and Jewish members of his own family as being an important tie? Or do they see his general character and attitude as giving way to racism or white supremacy and therefore a danger to Jews? We'll give you some more Jewish opinions a little later in the broadcast. Going to go to your calls next. 866-348-7884.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So is Donald Trump good for the Jewish people of America or not? This happened. You know, it just happened. Instead of playing our Jewish music clip, our team played the tease from the beginning of the show. I guess they wanted you to hear that again. So what do Jewish people think about Donald Trump? We'll get into that in a little while. 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related question or challenge you have for me, phone lines are open. We'll start with Israel in Oahu, Hawaii. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Aloha, Dr. Brown.
Aloha.
I had a two-part question.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Jewish understanding of Satan?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess specifically in the context of 1 Chronicles 21:1 and 2 Samuel 24:1, there seems to be a seeming contradiction where Yahweh is used, or the name Yahweh is used, and he incites David to do a census. And in 1 Chronicles, it talks about Satan inciting David. Yet when I look in the Old Testament in the context of how Satan is used, I notice that it's used more as a job description rather than a proper noun. And so I'm just curious how you reconcile those two and what is the overall Jewish understanding of Satan?
Great. Appreciate the questions. So let's deal with the apparent contradiction first between 2 Samuel 24:1 and 1 Chronicles 21:1. 2 Samuel the text saying that the anger of the Lord incited David to number Israel, and 1 Chronicles 21 saying that it was Satan who incited them. So what we see clearly here is that there is further insight into what's happening behind the scenes with the earlier book, Samuel, and the later book, Chronicles. Explicit mentions of Satan as this being, this angelic, malevolent being, do not occur until later in Israelite history. You say, well, isn't the book of Job the oldest book in the Bible? The account is an ancient account, but the writing of the book is much later. Genesis 3 does not mention Satan as Satan speaks of the snake in the garden. The main references we have to Satan are then in Job 1 and 2, HaSatan, the adversary, the accuser, and in Zechariah, the third chapter, where he appears again, and he is rebuked by the angel of the Lord. And what we see is that earlier on, the entire emphasis in what God was revealing is there's one God and one God only. The gods of the nations are false. They are not to be worshipped. They are not to be followed. All power belongs to the Lord. And idolatry was the great, great bane of the Jewish people, of Israel through history, but was largely purged out in terms of the worship of foreign gods and bowing down to wooden stone, was largely purged out by the exile. First and Second Chronicles are written after the exile, First and Second Samuel hundreds of years before. So the first perspective simply tells us that God is angry with David and takes direct responsibility for inciting him. Chronicles, written much later, when God could now reveal more of what was happening behind the scenes, tells us that Satan was the vehicle used in doing this. And it certainly should be looked at as Satan. In other words, not just some adversary or accuser, but Satan, HaSatan, the adversary, the accuser with a capital A, if you like. What is Judaism overall? How does Judaism view Satan? In ways similar to the way Christians do, but in ways differently. Similar in that he's malevolent, that he's an accuser, that he's an adversary, that he does evil and wicked things, but different in that in Judaism, you do not have a kingdom of God versus a kingdom of darkness and a battle going on in that respect. Rather, Satan is part of God's creation, and even though he does evil, malevolent things, he is still God's Satan. That's often the way Jews would put it. So there would be a difference in viewpoint, Christians emphasizing spiritual warfare more. Satan goes about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he can devour, resist him steadfast in the faith. You know, verses and concepts like that, I've given you authority over the devil and demons. Some of that is in Judaism, but not emphasized in that way. And it would be more the way you get it from Job 1 and 2, that he's doing certain things, but constrained and within limits. And that would be more the extent of it. We get more insight into it through the rest of the Bible and into the New Testament.
So prior to Jesus, and it seems in the New Testament, it becomes clear that there definitely is this malevolent being. Mm-hmm. Was there like a key incident that caused the Jews to better understand Satan as a person rather than just a title for a general angelic being?
No, I just believe that there's, to my knowledge, there's no specific event that oh, now we get it, now we understand. Nor was there a specific document. It's just that God gave increased understanding so that by the time of the New Testament, there was a lot of belief in terms of Satan, demons, things like that. There was just much more understanding of the spiritual realm. So I just take it that little by little through the scriptures, God is unfolding it, and then the rest flows out from that naturally. Hey, Israel, thank you for the call. I appreciate it very much. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to Charles in Chicago. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Hey, great to be with you. First of all, I want to thank you personally for your ministry. I've learned quite a bit from your teachings and also watch your debates against Dr. White and with Dr. White.
Oh. Yeah.
And really appreciate how you approach a lot of tough topics with Scripture, with logic and wisdom, and not emotion.
Thanks. I
and
appreciate
so I very, very much appreciate your teaching.
Yes, go ahead.
All righty. So how do American Jews vote? I believe American Jews vote Trump for two specific reasons. Number one, he brought the American embassy to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
For I don't know how many years, 25, 30 years, every president, whether Republican or Democrat, had promised to do that, had promised to bring the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and never did, never followed through, and he did. And I think that's a big deal. And the second is, look at the amazing peace agreement, which I believe is historic, in the Middle East with the UAE and Sudan and Israel, and I believe Saudi Arabia will follow. I think that's a huge deal, you know, for peace in the Middle East with Israel. And I think that the strategy involved there is brilliant, because I believe eventually, if it continues and more Middle Eastern countries join that peace accord, it's going to surround the real enemy to Israel, which is Iran.
Yeah, and Charles, you're exactly right in saying that, in that some of these countries are now signing agreements with Israel based on the philosophy of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So they
right.
have a common enemy with Iran, and then with the Iran-Turkey alliance. The thing that's interesting, Charles, is that your average evangelical Christian is more concerned about what's happening in Israel than your average American Jew, by which I mean that the things that you just raised would be massive factors for evangelical Christians, and would be factors, but not necessarily as massive with American Jews, not because they're isolated from Israel or they don't care about Israel, but often their perspective is, hey, we're concerned about the Palestinians as well. And we just want, you know, fairness and equality. And, you know, you move the embassy and that's good, but it could, you know, rock the boat and things like that. So if you ask your average evangelical Christian, give me a list of your top three items that influence your vote, they're likely to say abortion, number one, maybe freedom of religion or family values, number two, and Israel, number three. They may have the order different, but probably those three. If you ask an American Jew what issues matter to you most, Israel, our relations with Israel, might be four or five or seven on the list, probably wouldn't be in the top three. But I'm with you, Charles, in terms of how American Jews should vote. 866-34-TRUTH. Before I go back to the phones, I want to start going through a lengthy article. It is posted by Eli Steinberg, or Ellie Steinberg, and Joel Swanson, posted yesterday. A debate, is Trump good or bad for the Jews? Is Trump good or bad for the Jews? So I'm going to read some of this. I'm not trying to persuade you of a position. I just want you to know how various Jews are thinking. So Joel Swanson says, this week the American Jewish Community Committee released a groundbreaking survey about anti-Semitism in America. The results were sobering. 82% of Jews think anti-Semitism has increased in the past 5 years. I agree with that. Nearly half of us feel less secure than we did a year ago. And 7 out of 10 U.S. Jews think the Republican Party has a serious anti-Semitism problem, compared to only 4 out of 10 who think that about the Democratic Party. And fully 3/4 of American Jews think the far right poses a very serious or moderately serious threat to Jewish safety in the United States today, compared to only 1/3 who feel that way about the far left. And he says, if Trump is really good for the Jews, why is he opposed by the vast majority of American Jews who also think that he and his party bear personal responsibility for dramatically rising anti-Semitism in the country? To that, I'll give my 2 cents here. I have to say, wow, that's fascinating. Because overwhelmingly, you can document anti-Semitism in the Democrat Party and on the left more than in the Republican Party and on the right. I mean, you go far left, far right, they're both going to be anti-Semitic. It's just Jews always get it from either side. But where do you see much of the rising tide in terms of sentiments, in terms of BDS movements, in terms of college campuses, in terms of the political scene? That's mainly anti-Semitism from the left. Very interesting. Back with more. Stay here.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Great to be with you. If you got a question for me, Jewish-related, that's what has to be on Thursday, 866-348-7884, 866-34-TRUTH, with your Jewish-related questions. Going to the phones momentarily, but I want to read responses. I'm looking at Jewish views about Donald Trump and how Jews feel about voting for him. Come Tuesday. Again, it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thought this would be a good time to dig a little deeper. There's a debate dialogue between Jill Swanson and Eli Steinberg, not sure he pronounces his first name, over on the forward.com. So Jill Swanson has said, hey, look, anti-Semitism is rising in America. Most Jews think it's coming more from the Republicans and the right than from the Democrats and the left. So that's why they're not going to vote for Donald Trump. Eli Steinberg responds by saying this. The question which lies before us is whether reelecting Donald Trump is good for Jews, not whether most Jews will be supporting him in the upcoming election. We can agree that they will not be voting Trump. The question is why? And the answer is that for most Jews, the issues most important to them have nothing to do with Judaism at all. As the 2012 Public Religion Research Institute found, 66% of Jews said the economy and income equality were their top priorities. What's more, 46% of Jews define their actual Jewish identity as a commitment to social justice and equality, double those who define their Jewishness in terms of religious observance. I mean, that's extraordinary. Cultural heritage and tradition or general set of values. 46% said their actual Jewish identity is a commitment to social justice and equality, and only 17% said religious observance. 6% cultural heritage and tradition, and 3% general set of values. So there needs to be a clear distinction here, he writes. Are we discussing whether Trump is good for progressives who happen to be ethnically Jewish? Or are we going to take a hard look at which one of the two tickets before us is better for Jews, qua Jews, Jews as Jews? That is the question we're debating. And on that, he says there's no question. President Trump has made religious liberty a consistent priority. Whereas his challenger, Joe Biden, has taken the opposite path, promising to go back to court with the nuns of the Little Sisters of the Poor to force them to do something they say will violate their sincerely held beliefs. And his VP pick, Kamala Harris, sponsored a law to water down the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, essentially putting the government in charge of determining what legitimate exercise of religion is. So which one of the two is good for the Jews? So my reasoning here, of course, lies with Steinberg versus Swanson. But I'm just bringing you in. Into some of the debate, some of the discussion. We'll get into this a little more, but back to your calls. And we start with our friend Manny in Brooklyn. How you doing today?
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hey there.
I saw a video by you on Isaiah chapter 7, and you were, you know, answering the question why Isaiah did not use the word Besula. And you gave, I think, like three reasons why not. One of them was this: you have lots of times in the Bible the word bacher and besula, or like young man, or like chosen man and maiden. Isn't the word bacher used lots of times to refer to an unmarried man, especially nowadays, and perhaps back then in biblical times?
Right. So Manny, for the sake of our listeners and viewers that aren't familiar with this, let me just give a second of background, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
Isaiah 7:14 says, Hineha ma'ara violetet ben v'karat shemo Immanuel, which most translations, especially Jewish translations, would render, look, the virgin is, the young woman is pregnant and about to conceive, or is about to be pregnant and conceive, and will give birth to a child named Immanuel, just, you know, roughly. The key thing is that Jewish translators and many modern liberal translators say, look, Alma does not mean virgin, and therefore it's a mistranslation when the Septuagint translates it with Parthenos, and when Matthew uses Parthenos in Greek, and it's a misconception. It has nothing to do with virgin birth, has nothing to do with Jesus, and that the right word to use would be Betula, which means virgin. And my answer to that in terms of why Betulah was not used is that, one, if Betulah is not in a specific legal context dealing with virginity, it doesn't in and of itself mean virgin any more than Alma does. And that Alma has to do not with virginity, but with age and coming into to puberty. That's more what it ties in with. So it could be virginity or not, depending. But that also that you have, say, Joel 1:8, wail like a Betulah who's mourning for the husband of her youth, that would suggest she's already married. You have other ancient Near Eastern usage of both that could go in either direction. So you would agree, Manny, that talking about Bachur today is really not relevant, like how the word is used in modern Hebrew or in contemporary rabbinic literature. That's really not an issue, right?
It's not so much an issue. It's just what I know, based on the terms used a lot. When someone's unmarried, they call him a Bachur. I'm wondering if that was also the usage in biblical times, too.
No, there's no evidence that I'm aware of in any lexicons that I've looked at, any word studies. And that's why you'll see many Jewish translations just say young men and young women. So, you know, Bachurim, Ubetulot, it would just be young men and young women as opposed to young men, young virgin men and young virgin women. In fact, there's really, think of it today. If you want to talk about a man who's a virgin, what's the single word that you would use in rabbinic law or in just modern Hebrew?
For a young man?
Yeah, a young man who is a man of any age who's a virgin. What specific word would you use for that?
In specific, maybe bustle?
Right, but in other words, you don't have that in the Bible. You have Betulah, you don't have
Bustle. You don't have the word bustle in the Bible.
Basically, there wasn't an emphasis on male virginity the way there was on female virginity, and that's why you have all the laws about Betulim having to do with virginity. Let me say this. I do not believe for a moment that Alma in and of itself must be translated virgin. I would never argue that. I'm happy to translate with young woman of marriageable age, but presumably not pregnant. And in other words, for example, what does Rashi say? You know, Rashi says that the sign was that she was just an Alma and wasn't suitable for giving birth. So that's the thing. In other words, there's something striking about the prophecy and something that God himself is going to do as a sign, which Matthew then looks and sees the sign was the virgin giving birth. But in and of itself, unless you add a phrase with either Alma or Betulah, an Alma or a Betulah who never knew a man, it's not explicitly virgin. So I don't think when the prophecy was heard, everyone said, oh, there's going to be a virgin birth, because it could have even been a prophecy about a woman who is now an Alma, right? She's of marriageable age, but she's not married. And she's going to be married, and she's going to be pregnant. You know, it could have been that. So it's only through the lens of time that we see the full meaning of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think regarding Joel chapter 1, verse 8,
yeah,
you're definitely aware of many translators who say that, you know, it's totally possible, or, you know, that it could be a virgin who is legally married but didn't yet have sex.
Like, yes, a spouse, you see in, right.
We see in Deuteronomy 22, a person who doesn't find the word is besulim, or virginity, of his wife, and, you know, takes her to court, you know, on the count of adultery. So can't that necessarily also be virgin in that context as well?
It's possible. In other words, it is possible to argue that way, that she's espoused. So it's called husband because in Jewish law, he'd already be viewed as her husband. So she's mourning for him because they've never actually been married and she's still a virgin. It's possible to read it like that. Yeah. In other words, it's a good argument the other way, because so many times Betulah does not specifically mean virgin, and in and of itself does not have to mean virgin. And we have other examples, you know, just, you know, you have goddesses called the virgin this or that, and they're promiscuous, you know. So obviously it doesn't, you know, in Ugaritic literature and things like that. Or, you know, Babylon looked at as a Betulah, and she's mourning the loss of her children. So, again, you can't be dogmatic. My simple thing is, when someone says, If Isaiah clearly wanted to communicate virgin, he would have said betulah. I said, no, not necessarily. If he wanted to make it totally unambiguous, it would have been either an alma or a betulah who never slept with a man, or never knew a man. Then it would be unambiguous.
But wouldn't you admit it's less ambiguity if they would just use the word betulah, just less ambiguous?
Well, possibly. But the fact that Septuagint translates it with Parthenos, which is a couple hundred years before the time of Jesus, and that Rashi, despite Christian polemics, 1,200 years after Septuagint, suggested an alma was not expected to give birth or capable of giving birth, I would say that both are very strong in terms of unlikely words to be used for a married woman pregnant with a child.
But do you really think Rashi meant virgin birth, or do you think maybe he meant like a woman who couldn't give birth, like either Sarah or Rebecca, and that would be like some sort of miracle that way?
Oh, well, he certainly wasn't talking about a virgin birth. We agree with that Rashi did not believe in the virgin birth, right?
But
his word, if I remember, is ruyah. It wasn't suitable. It wasn't expected or normal. So the question would be, because she's only an alma. So here, I'll just read to you what he says, okay? And then, so some interpret that this is the sign that she was a young girl and incapable of giving birth. So that's how the most respected Rashi translator reads it, and that's on Chabad.org on their website. That's how they understand it. So there's something about her youthfulness, and that could be the argument that Alma would immediately point to a younger woman incapable of giving birth, and that's the better word to use. To me, it's a fair debate to have, but I think if we agree on this, sir, that it was not a it was not unambiguous either way, unless you factor in that there was something about the birth that was miraculous, because God tells Hezekiah, ask for, you know, a sign above, below, whatever, and he says, I won't. He says, okay, then I'm going to give you a sign. And when you read various commentaries, the question is, well, what was the sign? What was the nature of the sign? But listen, if you can, stay right there for a moment, and I want to talk to you on the other side of the break. Appreciate it.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon. And the
songs of Marty Goetz. This is Thirdly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us. So Manny in Brooklyn, just if you don't have Rashi memorized or in front of you, V'yesh Potrin, there are those who interpret she'zeh ha'ot, this is the sign, she'alma ha'ita, that she was an alma, ve'eina ruyah livaled, and not capable of giving birth. So just wanted to read that. Manny, if you don't mind me asking, what was it that drew you in to watch this video in the first place?
Well, actually, it was I was in a debate with a pastor regarding this passage, and I argued to him that the word virgin is, you know, the word alma does not mean virgin, and he insisted that the word alma did mean virgin. So I tried to find him sources for, you know, so that he wouldn't, you know, be, and I found you, and I was glad you helped me.
All right. Yeah, so I helped you part way, because I still have my larger argument. And obviously, just you're quoting these and the your Hebrew pronunciation, so you're raised in a religious family?
Yeah.
And you're still from Jew today?
Yeah.
Yeah, so who do you think Jesus was?
I don't know exactly. I'm more of the opinion that he was probably a maybe a Shabtai Tzvi of his day.
Okay, so a charismatic false messiah of his day.
Perhaps.
Uh-huh.
I think I recently had this thought. I don't know. I mean, because obviously I don't accept the New Testament as, historically accurate. I was thinking that I do see a little bit more violence come towards the crucifixion. Jesus turning over the tables on the Temple Mount, and Peter cutting off the ear of the people coming to arrest him. It seems to me maybe there was some conflict at the end, or there was some fear of rebellion, and maybe that's why he was killed.
Got it. Okay. Have you ever read my book, The Real Kosher Jesus?
No.
So I wrote that in response to my friend Rabbi Shmuley's book, Kosher Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And in that,
I took a debate with him.
Okay. So he argues, which one? Do you remember on that subject? Or a different one?
On the subject, it was, which one was that? It was in It's Supernatural, and I think it was North Carolina.
Oh, okay. We did that for Sit on TV. Got it. So you weren't one of those, because we've done many in New York City. But Shmuley wrote Kosher Jesus, and he tried to argue mm-hmm. that Jesus was not a false Messiah, but a failed Messiah, and mm-hmm. that he was a freedom fighter against Rome, and he died fighting for his people. So he wrote Kosher Jesus. I wrote Real Kosher Jesus in response, where I interact with that and have a chapter where I interact with the violence question. I don't know if you have a safe address where I could send it as a gift for you to read it. The reason I say safe address is many times when I'm interacting with a from Jew or someone in the Hasidic community, they say, well, I'd love to get your stuff, but you can't send it to me because I can't be caught with it.
I was already caught with your stuff.
All right. So listen, if you like, when we're done talking, you stay on hold for a moment. We won't put you on any mailing list. It's not going to be added to our database. We just send it out as a gift. The only request is that once you're able to read it, that you give me a call and tell me what you thought afterwards.
Is that okay?
All right. Anything else you just want to raise while we're on the phone together?
I was wondering about the topic of Bachur, and that there's no real Hebrew word in the Bible for that term. Is that perhaps because Bachur, even though it kind of means chosen, it was also kind of used like it is today, just as Basula is used today?
What I would suggest, Manny, if you'll really study it out, is that you'll see there was not a category for a virginal male. And that, mm-hmm. For example, a bachur is speaking more about a state of age than a state of sexuality. For example, mm-hmm. I'm quite sure that a 50-year-old man who somehow never married, or say Jeremiah, who God told never to marry in Jeremiah 16, I'm quite sure that at the age of 50, he would not have been called a bachur, because
right.
even though he would, right. So that would indicate that. And what I do normally is I'll take a, used to be my concordance, I had Mandelkern, and then after the Evan Shoshan, concordance of Tanakh, but now of course just with software. And what I'll do is I will just look at every single reference. Just in other words, I don't know anything. I have no preconception. And I just read them, 10, 20, 50, 100, 200. And then you just read them in Hebrew, and then you start to put them in categories, and you see how they break down. And I feel quite confident that if you'll do that, you'll see that Bachur is not specifically used with reference to a virginal male, and hence a parallel to Betula. Rather, it's the way I'm saying it, that Bachur and Betula is just young men and young women. But anyway, stay right there. We're going to send you a copy of The Real Kosher Jesus. And whenever you're able to read it, if it's a month from now or 6 months from now, give me a call or write to us and let us know your thoughts. I'd love to interact further. And I'm glad you found my videos. All right. So Rachel is going to get your mailing address, and it'll be our joy to send that out to you. All right. Let us go to Lou in New York City. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. How's it going?
Going very well, thank you.
Great. It was pretty nice and interesting to hear you evangelize just a second ago. It was
what a joy! Hey, listen, you're a New Yorker, so you run into religious Jews all the time, whether you're talking or not. You know, they're in the world you live in. And there's nothing I like better than having an educated Jewish person, a committed Jewish person, a religious Jew, call in and having a civil conversation. He's raising valid points, great, you know, and so I want to use every second to interact with him and really honor that and his interest, and then try to make it educational for everyone without leaving folks out. So hopefully we accomplish both, and we can pray that God would reveal the fullness of his goodness and truth to our friend Manny. So, back to you, Luth. Thank you.
Amen to that. I was. It's always exciting to hear the prospect of possibly speaking to the remnant of Israel. Kind of just leave it at that. Anywho, to your question, how should American Jews vote? Now, mm-hmm. I think the obvious answer between, us and probably most of your audience is, of course, Trump. The question also begs a bunch of different things, but I think we can see the answer really from two different perspectives. It's historical, and we can also see things in real world, like today. And I think today is probably the more important of, because obviously it's the world that everybody's living in. So the left, we can see empirically, is a lot more hostile. And I'm not just talking about the cultural left. I'm talking about the political left is a lot more hostile to the Jews. And we can see that in the examples of what Cuomo and de Blasio actually did to the Hasids by shutting certain things down and actually, basically coming to the point of threatening imprisonment. And I think as time goes by, this is kind of like that stepping stone or that slippery slope that these things can actually become a reality. People don't think that can actually happen. But look, we incarcerated our own Japanese, some decades ago. And it's absolutely a possibility, right? So from that perspective, we can see that. And I think everybody should balk at it. And I hope that the Jews there actually woke up and realized that the left is not their friend. I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of bad business that happens between the left and that community, which allows them to do a lot of things economically and without turning a blind eye to things that are not so kosher. I'll just leave it at that, and I think you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it happens more times than often, right? And then the left is very open to those business dealings.
Lou, so the perception is, as I was just reading some of the back and forth debate on the forward between Jill Swanson and Eli Steinberg, that the perception is that the right is more anti-Semitic than the left. This is how many Jews look at it, that the far right is more dangerous than the far left. The reality is the far right and the far left are always dangerous. The extremes on any side are always dangerous. But as you're saying, in our society today, when are synagogues being vandalized? Well, let's say during a BLM Antifa protest. And where is there being unfair treatment of Jews? Well, it's right now happening in Democratic city or state like New York. And on college campuses, the ideologies there, is it the far right putting forward their anti-Semitism? Is it the alt-right and the Richard Spencers putting forth their anti-Semitism, or the David Dukes on the college and university campuses? No, it's the left that's doing it and driving the BDS movement and things like that. And then when you have the Republican Party so dominated by or so impacted by evangelical Christians who are so strongly pro-Israel and pro-Jewish, and then you have the Democratic Party leaching more towards an anti-Semitic position, it does seem that Jewish people are evaluating this wrongly here, that they are not weighing things equally. If anti-Semitism is a big factor, then you vote Republican versus Democrat. Now, obviously, there are going to be other things that are going to influence Jewish voters. But, Lou, I'm with you on that. And, let's learn from history. Anything can happen. And it's scary to see how the religious Jews of New York have been treated recently. All right, friends, the good news is Jesus, Yeshua, is still Lord in the midst of the chaos. Let's turn our attention to the one true God, worship and honor him, and pray, Lord, your will be done in the coming elections.